Hello, and welcome to Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. I've been kind of saving this case for a while, and this week I decided to really dive in. I will never forget seeing this episode of Forensic Files, which is where I got a lot of the information and images for today's episode. You know, when there's a case that just hits different, for whatever reason, there are elements of the story that line up very closely with your own story, and you really see yourself in the victim, see your own family in the victim's family. Well, this is one of those stories for me. The victim in our story led a similar life to mine, looks a little like I did back then, came from a nice family like I do, and has sisters like I do. Just things that line up, you know? But far beyond that, I learned some very important lessons from this story. Things that not only have I never forgotten, but things that changed the way I do everyday tasks. Things that changed some very specific mundane chores we all do every day. The first time I heard this story, I was sitting on my couch with my kids snuggled up around me. Some of them were tired, so they were just watching the show with me, and one of them was playing with Legos on the floor. And as the story went on, I realized that it was pretty disturbing, and I said, "We should turn this off." And one of my girls said, "No, we have to see what happens." So I let them watch it. As adults, my kids tease me about the fact that I might have let them watch things that were maybe a little too scary for them at times, because that's the kind of stuff I like. I often wonder if that was a mistake, but they say they're fine and we just joke about it now. This is, in fact, a very scary story. Scarier than most, because not only do we have a young woman who vanished into thin air from a very safe place, we have a criminal who took pure joy and pure pleasure in taunting her family after he did the unthinkable. This is the story of Larry Jean Bell, of Sherry Smith, and of her last will and testament. Let's get into it. May 31st, 1985. 17-year-old Sherry Smith is just getting ready to graduate from high school. She had finished all of her school projects, turned in the last tests, and was excited not only to graduate, but to sing the national anthem at graduation. After graduation, she and her classmates were planning to set sail on a cruise to celebrate their achievement. Sherry lived in Lexington County, South Carolina, with her father, Bob Smith, her mother, Hilda Smith, and her siblings. The Smiths were a well-known family in the area. They were well-liked and they were respected. They lived here in this country house at the end of a long drive that branched off the main road. Near the entrance to that long drive was the family mailbox, and it was common for Sherry to stop there to check the mail when she was coming and going. On May 31st, one of Sherry's last school days ever, Bob Smith was sitting in his home office when some movement at the end of the long drive caught his eye. It was Sherry at the end of the driveway, pulling in her little car. Bob watched as she stopped at the mailbox, and then he went on about his work. About 10 minutes went by, and Bob realized he hadn't heard Sherry come into the house. So he looked down the long drive, and he saw Sherry's car was still sitting there at the mailbox. Bob later claimed he had a very strange feeling, and so he went to the garage, got in his car, and drove down the long drive from the house to the mailbox. When he got to Sherry's car, his heart sunk. Sherry's car was sitting just where he had first seen it when she pulled in. The driver's side door was open, and the engine was running, but Sherry was nowhere in sight. Bob saw barefooted footprints from Sherry's car to the mailbox. There were no footprints leading from the mailbox back to the car. Bob immediately knew something was wrong. The Smith house was on a large piece of land with no close neighbors. It wasn't as if Sherry perhaps got talking with the person next door. There was no next door. This was a very isolated area in the country. Bob drove back to the house where he alerted his wife, Hilda. When he told her that Sherry's car was down by the mailbox, running and empty, Hilda said, "Oh my God, not my Sherry." The police were called immediately and they arrived at the house within minutes. Unlike many cases where people vanish into thin air, the police went into action right away. Everyone knew there was something very, very wrong. A search was initiated and soon hundreds of police and neighbors and townspeople alike were searching for Sherry Smith. Lexington County Sheriff Jim Metz took the disappearance very seriously, and he called on all of his resources to try and find the missing woman. Girl, really. Within hours, the search for Sherry Smith had become the largest search and rescue operation ever initiated in South Carolina. Sherry's parents spoke to the media and pleaded for their daughter's safe return. No one had any idea who had taken Sherry. Was it a stranger or was it someone that they knew? They had nothing to go on and not a clue who they were chasing. All they knew is that they wanted Sherry back. For 2 days, the police and the people of the Lexington County area searched for Sherry, and they found absolutely nothing. And then the telephone inside the Smith house rang. The caller was a man, and his voice was distorted, as though he was trying to sound like someone else. He demanded to speak with Mrs. Smith, and she came to the phone. The caller told Hilda that he had Sherry, and to prove it, he described the patterned black and yellow bathing suit Sherry was wearing under her shorts. The caller told Hilda that he would release Sherry, that she would be fine, and that the two of them were watching a little TV. He said Sherry had eaten a little food and that he was giving her lots of water and not to worry. She was okay. The caller then said the Smiths would be receiving a letter in the morning with further instructions as to what to do, and he hung up. Federal agents went right to work tapping the phones at the Smith house so that if the caller called again, they would be set up to record the calls, and that turned out to be a very smart decision. After a very sleepless night at the house, the decision was made to have the family and the citizens of the area help the post office go through the mail before it was delivered because they simply didn't want to wait. They woke up the postmaster on a Sunday morning and descended on the small town post office to start searching for the letter addressed to the Smith family. The police had the volunteers put on plastic gloves and they went through each piece until they found this. The envelope they were all searching for. Everyone waited with bated breath as the envelope was opened and the letter inside was removed. It was a handwritten document written in Sherry's hand, and it was entitled Last Will and Testament. Sherry's friends, family, and supporters began to cry, but they were hopeful that Sherry might still be alive. The letter said, in part, "Please don't ever let this ruin your lives. Just keep on living one day at a time for Jesus. Some good will come out of this. My thoughts will always be with and in you." Also in the letter were the words, "Casket closed." Sherry could see into her future, and she knew she would not be in good condition when they found her, and she didn't want anyone to see her like that. And I find that very heart-wrenching and also very sound. It says a lot about who Sherry was as a person. She was thinking rationally and she had a good head on her shoulders and she knew what she wanted. It's such a personal, intimate detail, you know, hearing from someone who knows they're going to die. I don't want to be seen in bad condition. It's really touching. This wasn't a young woman, a girl, who was hysterical. This was a person with a very solid head on their shoulders who accepted her fate and who was trying to spare others the tough decisions that she knew lay ahead. And there's something so courageous about that to me. The letter was sent off to SLED. We've all become very familiar with SLED via the Murdoch trial. And it was turned over to the forensics unit at SLED so their investigators could examine the letter looking for anything that might be of help to them. Of course, everyone was devastated by the letter and on pins and needles, wondering what would come next. And then the kidnapper called again. June 2nd, 1985. The mood inside the Smith house is, as you can imagine, very tense and very dark. The home is filled with FBI agents and a few very close family supporters. The phone inside the home rings again, and this time they're ready for the call. Hilda Smith seems to be the person the kidnapper wants to speak with most, so she takes the call.
Have you received the mail today?
Yes, I have.
Do you believe me now?
Well, I'm not really sure I believe you because I haven't had any word from Sherry. And I need to know that Sherry is well.
You'll know in 2 or 3 days.
Why 2 or 3 days?
Call the search off.
As you heard in that very disturbing clip, Hilda Smith tells the kidnapper she wants to hear from Sherry in order to believe that she is still alive and well. The kidnapper says she will know in 2 or 3 days, and then he hangs up. Well, the Smiths didn't have to wait 2 or 3 days. The killer called back that night.
Okay, 4:58 a.m. No, I'm sorry, hold on a minute. 3:10 a.m. Saturday, the 1st of June, she handwrote what you received. 4:58 a.m. Saturday, the 1st of June.
Okay, Saturday, the 1st of June, 4:58 a.m.
Became one soul.
Became one soul. What does that mean?
No questions now. Please, to assure Smiths, search no more. Blessings are near.
Do not kill my daughter, please. I mean, please.
We love and miss y'all. Get good rest tonight. Goodbye.
Wait a minute. He's gone, Mom.
As you heard, the kidnapper makes some very, very disturbing statements, like, Sherry is now a part of me, emotionally, spiritually. It's just very weird and very dark and very terrifying. I can't even imagine what Sherry's family was going through at that time. The FBI traced the incoming call to a payphone at a drugstore in downtown Lexington. But back in 1985, there weren't cameras everywhere like there are now, so they had no way to get a look at the kidnapper. It had now been 5 days since Sherry's abduction. Sherry's family was understandably exhausted, and you could cut the tension with a knife inside the home. And then the phone rang again. This time the kidnapper spoke with both Hilda and Sherry's sister Dawn. And this time he had some very specific instructions.
Hello?
Listen carefully. Take Highway 378 West to Traffic Circle. Take Prosperity Exit. Go 1.5 miles. Turn right at sign. Moose Lodge number 103. Go 1/4 mile. Turn left at white frame building. Go to backyard. 6 feet beyond, we're waiting. God chose us.
The killer gives very clear driving directions to the Smiths. Hilda Smith begged the police officers to let her go with them, hoping beyond hope that she would find her daughter alive and well, and wanting to be there for her as she was found. But the police were more realistic, and they wanted to protect Hilda, and they refused to let her ride with them. Unfortunately, this was the right thing to do. As the police followed the directions the kidnapper gave them, past the Saluda Lodge, down the road 1/4 mile, and to this abandoned white house, they walked into the backyard and they found her. Sherry Smith was dead in the backyard at the home. Laying on top of her body was the yellow top and shorts she had last been wearing. Her body was taken into custody and an autopsy was performed. It revealed that Sherry had been dead for several days. Based on conversations with the kidnapper, now killer, it was determined that Sherry had been killed on June 1st, 1985, a couple of hours after writing her last will and testament. The killer had been taunting the family after she was dead. She had only lived 12 hours after her abduction. Forensic examination then revealed that Sherry's body had been outside for the days after the murder. The police then formed the opinion that the killer had dumped her body after murdering Sherry and then used the calls to try and buy himself time to stave off a search in hopes that exposure to the elements would erase any evidence that he might have missed. Forensic examiners also found duct tape residue on Sherry's mouth and wrists. The duct tape had been wrapped tightly around Sherry's head, so much so that the killer had to cut the duct tape out of Sherry's hair. It was determined that she had been murdered by suffocation. The killer wrapped her nose and mouth and waited for her to die, and that is just absolutely horrific and barbaric and pure evil. I can't think of a lot of worse ways to go than that. I think about the worst ways to go a lot. It's just the way my mind works. The FBI created a profile for the killer. The profile indicated that the killer would be a white man with a failed marriage behind him. It said he would most likely not be married at the time, mid-20s to early 30s, with a history of sex crimes. The profile said that the distortion of the killer's voice was produced by using what's called a voice speed analysis unit. And that meant that either through his employment or other technical knowledge, the killer knew about these devices. Remember, no internet back then, no way to just jump online and order up a voice distortion machine delivered to your door. We didn't even know things like that existed back then. So this was very telling. This had to be someone who had knowledge of technology and electronics. The FBI also believed that the killer had written scripts for each of his phone calls, and he was reading from them as he called. As a final slap in the face to this grieving family, this piece of human garbage called the Smith family on the night of Sherry's funeral. Oh my gosh, these guys. Oh, I hate them. He wanted to tell them exactly how he had murdered Sherry and even asked Hilda Smith, "Can you take it? Doesn't that make you angry and sick?" And of course Hilda couldn't take it, but as a mother, she did. She was trying to keep this monster on the phone as long as possible so the FBI could trace the calls. As if this wasn't bad enough, the taunting of this poor family to that point, the killer called back a week later. And if it could possibly get worse, it did. He didn't want to talk about Sherry anymore. Now the killer wanted to talk about another missing girl, a 10-year-old named Deborah Mae Hemlick. Deborah Mae Hemlick had been abducted from the front yard of her trailer park home in the middle of the day on June 14th, with her own father standing less than 20 feet away inside the door. The police were getting nowhere on the disappearance, and because it happened a county away from the Sherry Smith abduction, they hadn't linked the two crimes. The killer was about to do that for them, though.
Have you heard about Deborah Mae Hemlick?
No.
The 10-year-old, H-E-L-M-I-C-K.
Richland County?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Okay, listen carefully. Turn right, last dirt road before you come to stop sign at Two Notch Road. Go due chain and no trespassing sign. Go 50 yards and to the left, go 10 yards. Deborah Mae is waiting. God forgive us all.
They followed the killer's instructions and they found Deborah Mae Hemlick right where the killer said she would be. And now they knew they were dealing with a serial killer. The FBI updated the profile of the killer to include the fact that his behavior would be changing at this point. He might be losing a lot of weight or drinking more heavily than usual. Perhaps he would stop shaving, stop bathing, but it would be something that would be noticeable to those around him. Back at the forensics lab led by SLED, investigators were still going over the last will and testament of Sherry Smith. As you can see, it was written on very standard and common lined notebook paper. At the beginning of this episode, I said that this story forever changed the way I do some very specific things, very mundane things, and this is what I mean by that. Investigators decided to run the letter written by Sherry's own hand through something called an electrostatic detection apparatus. The pages of any document to be examined are first put into a humidifier to add moisture to the paper. The moisture increases the reactivity to electrostatic energy. The humidified document is then placed on a brass plate and a magnetic wand is used over it, which exaggerates any indentations in the paper that might not be visible to the naked eye. After that, powder, similar to fingerprint powder, is brushed all over the document, and that allows whatever might not have been visible to become visible. So it is, in essence, a revealer of invisible ink, if you will. Only it's not ink, it's indentation. Before I heard this story, I had never thought about the fact that when you write on a notepad, you're not only writing on the page you're directly inking onto or penciling onto, you're also leaving indentations on the pages behind the one you're inking on. We all know this now, but again, this was 1985, and I was watching this episode more than 20 years ago. I wasn't watching it in 1985. I would guess it was probably more like 1990, but we just didn't think about things like that back then. To this day, from the day I watched this episode to this day, if I write something on a notepad that is in any way private, or if it's not a notepad that I own, if it's like in a hotel room or someone else's house, I tear out the next three pages and I throw them away. Again, I don't do that if I've just made like a list or something, but if it's something private, yes, this case changed the way I write private information down. As you can see, there are some clearly visible words and numbers on the papers Sherry was given to write her last will and testament. Things that had been written on the pages above the pages Sherry wrote on, and that had left some indentations on Sherry's pages. It looks like some items for a grocery list, and it looks like phone numbers. The numbers are 205, which is the area code for Alabama, then 837, which is the prefix for the Huntsville area, and then they could see three of the four last numbers. Those numbers have never been made public. So investigators researched all 10 possible options for the missing number and came up with what they believed to be their most viable lead. They called the number and spoke to the man who owned it. They asked him, "Do you have any relatives in South Carolina?" And the man said, "Yes, my father and mother live in South Carolina. My father's name is Ellis Shepherd." So the police went to Ellis Shepherd's home and then pulled his phone records. There were phone calls from the home of Ellis Shepherd to the Smith home, to Sherry's home. Ellis Shepherd lived only 15 miles from the Smith family. 50-year-old Ellis Shepherd was cooperative with the police. He told the police that he and his wife were on a vacation when Sherry was abducted, and his alibi checked out. He had no idea why his son's phone number would have appeared on Sherry Smith's last will and testament. Investigators then played a clip of one of the phone calls the killer made to the Smiths so Ellis Shepherd could hear the man's voice. He immediately recognized it. Ellis Shepherd looked up and said, "That dirty son of a bitch." An investigator said, "Who is it?" And Ellis Shepherd said, "That's Larry Jean Bell." Larry Jean Bell worked for Ellis Shepherd as an electrician. Ellis himself was a master electrician and he employed other electricians. Ellis and his wife were going to be out of town for about 6 weeks, and they hired Larry Jean Bell to house sit for them while they were away for so long. Before leaving, Ellis wrote down a list of phone numbers, numbers belonging to people that Larry Jean Bell could call if he needed anything while they were gone. One of those numbers was that of Ellis's son in Alabama. And the best news yet, Ellis Shepherd still had those papers he had written the lists on. He turned them over to the investigators and they matched them up with Sherry's last will and testament. It was a mirror image. Ellis Shepherd then told investigators that when Larry Jean Bell picked them up at the airport, all he wanted to talk about was Sherry Smith's abduction and murder. He was obsessed. The Shepherds noticed that Larry Jean Bell had lost noticeable weight in just 6 weeks, and he had stopped shaving, just as the FBI profile said. He was also highly agitated, and that was not normal for him, so the FBI profile was spot on. A forensics team was sent to the Shepherd home, and they went through it with a fine-tooth comb. They found six blonde hairs in the bathroom that were microscopically similar to those belonging to Sherry Smith. They also found a roll of duck-themed stamps in Ellis Shepherd's desk drawer that matched the stamp on the outside of the letter sent to the Smith family. It was enough for an arrest warrant, and authorities took Larry Jean Bell into custody. The police and the press, and then the nation, got their first view of this man. Look at this little worm. And it gets even worse after they shave him. He's like a human parasite, this one, like a wrinkled thumb, little Weasley-looking thing, isn't he? And just like the FBI profile said he would, he had a very long history of sex crimes. So here we go again, the guy making the dirty phone calls, the guy who always has a snide comment for a woman, who always has a disgusting joke or something nasty to say. My friends, those guys are walking red flags. Real men who are just really into women, you know, they might look, they might give you a nod when they see something they like. And if you're a guy, you know, they might point somebody out, but they're not constantly talking about every woman in the room. They don't sit and obsess over women. They don't say disgusting things about women. Those are the people we all need to watch out for. And just as the FBI predicted, this monster had done not only all of those things his entire life, his teenage life into his adult life, but he had taken it all a step further, stalking, harassing, and intimidating women for years. Now, there are other crimes tied to Larry Jean Bell. He was, in fact, a serial killer, but I'm going to save those stories for the episode where we cover Larry Jean Bell. Today, we're covering the murder of Sherry Smith. He went on trial and made a mockery of the entire event because, of course, he did. He refused to answer questions. He would randomly blurt out nonsensical statements when he wasn't being spoken to. And then, of course, he began proclaiming that he was Jesus Christ. The other thing that came out at trial was just how obsessed Larry Jean Bell had become with Dawn, the Smith's other daughter. No one is actually sure whether or not Larry Jean Bell had actually targeted Dawn or Sherry. They looked quite a bit alike, and some people believe that Dawn was the intended target. During one of the 8 phone calls Larry Jean Bell made to the Smith house, he slipped up and said, "All I wanted to do was make love with Dawn," when he was speaking about Sherry. So that's a whole new level of gross in an already gross story. This disgusting little worm couldn't get a woman, so of course he resorted to forcing himself on them. The jury found him just as disgusting as I do. For the death of Sherry Smith, the murder of this beautiful young woman, the jury took only 47 minutes to convict Larry Jean Bell of first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to die. He was executed on October 4th, 1996, when he was 46 years old, and I will also be covering his execution on my playlist, Dining with the Damned. They made a TV movie about this case in 1991. It's known by 2 different titles. One is Nightmare in Columbia County, and the other is Victim of Beauty, The Dawn Smith Story. It stars William Dean as Sheriff Jim Metz and Jerry Ryan as Dawn Smith, who is the focus of the story in the film. You know, I had to watch it in preparation for this episode. It's very much TV movie of the week stuff. They make Dawn out to be the bait for the serial killer, and William Dean plays this really intense, angry sheriff. In real life, Dawn Smith went on to win Miss South Carolina in 1986. She went on to represent the state in the pageant world and inspired people as she spoke about the loss of her sister, Sherry. A young girl standing at the edge of adulthood, just ready to graduate from high school and take on the world. A young girl who lost all that lay ahead of her and lost her life simply because she stopped to check the mail one day, not knowing that a monster was watching and waiting for his moment. Thank you for joining me today on Dining with Death, True Crime Tuesday. Hit the like button if you liked the video. Subscribe to the channel if you want to support me. And you can always join my Patreon. That is really what's keeping the channel alive at this point. I'm Dining with Death on Patreon. And if you want to donate $1 a month, that's great. The end goal on Patreon is to be able to donate money to police departments that have cold case DNA in storage that cannot be tested because there's no money to test it. We want to help with that. I really appreciate you being here. You guys and your support means more to me than I will ever be able to tell you. Stay safe, my friends, and be kind to each other. And I'll see you next time on Dining with Death. Bye.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Mmm, boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? Mmm, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.